It was the perfect storm. When the Black Death or plague reached European shores in the 1300s, it devastated entire towns, cities, and countries. To the many who lived through that time, it felt like the world was truly ending. Death wasn't just a part of life, but a specter that haunted men, women, and children, from kings and queens to the lowest of peasants. On today's episode of History with Brittany, we'll be discussing the Black Death in Europe, its effects, and what it can tell us about the current coronavirus spreading throughout the world. The Black Death, or the Great Mortality, as it was known by those who lived through it, was a devastating pestilence that killed roughly 33% of Europe. In some cases, the death rate was closer to 60 or sometimes even 80%. Here's how one survivor described the experience. Quote, "Many dropped dead in the open streets by day and by night, whilst a great many others, though dying in their own houses, drew their neighbors' attention to the fact more by the smell of their rotting corpses than by any other means. And what with these and the others who were dying all over the city, bodies were here, there, and everywhere. It was not merely a question of one citizen avoiding another. This scourge had implanted such a great terror in the hearts of men and women that brothers abandoned brothers, uncles their nephews, sisters their brothers, and in many cases, wives deserted their husbands. But even worse, and most incredible, was the fact that fathers and mothers refused to nurse and assist their own children as though they did not belong to them." Unquote. Giovanni Boccaccio, Florence. Part 1, The Origins. Before the Black Death of the 14th century, the last time Europe dealt with the plague was during the reign of Justinian in the 500s, but this was different. In fact, scientists and researchers remain unsure what exact strain of plague affected the population, and some question if it even was the plague at all. The plague is a disease that is transmitted by fleas, not by rats, although that is a common misconception. There are three different types of plague: bubonic, pneumonic, septicemic. The first, bubonic, is known for its victims developing a tumor like a bubble on the skin, usually around the neck or the groin. Without treatment, only about 40% survive. Pneumonic, or the coughing plague, has a mortality rate of 95 to 100%, and it is the only plague that spreads from person to person. Usually the victims cough and spit blood. The last and most lethal is the septic plague, which has the unique ability to turn extremities black and hard as coal. It's incredibly uncommon and kills quickly. When there was another outbreak in the early 20th century, the average survival rate was about 14 and a half hours. Without treatment, it is 100% fatal. Strangely, the symptoms described were a combination of both the bubonic and pneumonic plague. Some plague deniers have even posited the possibility of anthrax, an unknown disease X, or an Ebola-like hemorrhagic fever as being the culprit, though some testing has proved that white pestis was present in one plague pit. Either way, millions were killed. Part 2, The Perfect Storm. At the beginning of the 14th century, Europe was finally reclaiming some of the former glory of the Roman Empire. The shadow of the Dark Ages was finally fading, and Europe was at a good point economically and politically, but things quickly took a turn for the worst. Urbanization, filth, the environment, war, and a devastating famine between 1315 and 1317 left the continent and its citizens vulnerable to the incoming pestilence. Frankly, it was a perfect storm. There were four main factors that helped lay the foundation for the plague to rip through Europe: the environment, trade and economy, urbanization, and the growing Mongol Empire. Though some of these situations run together, they all contribute in their own way. The first situation to look at is the environment. The climate across Europe and Asia was changing. An increasing amount of rain fell throughout the European continent, flooding fields and leading to a devastating famine that likely killed millions over the ensuing years, and believe it or not, might have directly contributed to the plague death toll in some areas. The babies born around that time would have had their immune systems compromised by lack of nutrition in the womb, and it left them particularly vulnerable to the effects of the plague. In fact, in one area, the plague deaths were rather minimal compared to others, in part because they had so many children that died during the famine. Another interesting environmental factor is the deforestation that occurred in some areas. Forests act like a barrier for the spread of disease. Without some of those forests, the plague was able to enter and easily spread, an unintended consequence of a previously booming economy and the resurgence of Europe in general. The second was trade and economy. As Europe reclaimed its former glory, that meant trade routes and interest in foreign goods was growing. In particular, the Venetians and Genoans were interested in increasing their profit margins by eliminating the middlemen, usually those from Muslim territories, who would increase the price of goods, sometimes by the thousands. If the Europeans could eliminate this competition by making their own way through the East, then they could easily increase their profits. For example, famous explorer Marco Polo, who was originally from Venice, was influenced to explore in part due to his family's interest in trade. This desire for Asian goods likely resulted in Europeans and other traders coming into contact with the Black Death for the first time. Some theories suggest that traders were exploring a different northern route and thus came into contact with the pestilence that would eventually impact life as they knew it. The third is urbanization. Europe, by the 14th century, was growing economically and politically, which resulted in an explosive expansion of urbanization in various areas. Cities were overcrowded, with people living on top of each other. It was also filthy. Bathing was an oddity, not a commonality. People also only had one or two outfits, which they would only change out of maybe once or twice a year. There was even one story about a man who took off his clothing and literally bugs crawled out everywhere. Not only were the people dirty, but the cities they lived in were as well. From sewage running down the streets to blood from local slaughterhouses, it was definitely an interesting time to be alive, but it also left many cities open to the plague. The proximity between people and animals resulted in the plague spreading quickly, eliminating entire neighborhoods within days. The fourth is the growing Mongol Empire. The catalyst that led the Genoan ships to the shores of Europe was the Mongol Empire's attack on the Genoan port city of Kaffa, which is essentially in modern-day Crimea in the Black Sea. As the forces attacked, the trade ships fled, taking the pestilence with them. These ghost ships carried the dead and dying to ports throughout the continent. The harbor cities did what they could, but it seemed like nothing could stop it. Part 3, the effects. Quote, first, a sort of boil, the size of a lentil, erupted on the thigh or arm. Then the victims violently coughed up blood, and after 3 days of incessant vomiting, for which there was no remedy, they died. And with them died not only everyone who had talked to them, but also anyone who acquired, touched, or laid hands on their belongings. Unquote. Sounds lovely, doesn't it? When it comes to the history of the Black Plague, it's actually a little hit and miss. It all depends on if that particular town or city had a chronicler of some sort who testified about what was happening. As this pestilence could strike both the wealthy and the destitute alike, no one was exempt. The disease first landed in the Sicilian city of Messina in October 1347. A Franciscan friar named Michele da Piazza wrote that the Genoa ships that arrived, quote, carried such a disease in their bodies that if anyone so much as spoke with one of them, he was infected and could not avoid death, unquote. Though they sent the infected men and their ships away, it didn't matter. As da Piazza wrote, cats and livestock follow their masters to their death, so no part of life was unaffected by the plague. Many of the stories about the plague mention the silence that seemed to follow the disease. As people died, it was the silence that just seemed to disturb others most. And the suddenness of the plague took people by complete surprise. Before it arrived on their shores, people had no idea this even existed, let alone killed in such large numbers, down to the smallest of animals. The people of Messina, utterly confused and terrified at this growing catastrophe, attempted to get the relics of St. Agatha from another city on the island. In the Middle Ages, a relic of a saint or someone who could be a saint was big business. Obviously, being a saint took time. And it could be an item they owned, but was more often their body or pieces of their body that were put in shrines in cities and towns. Honestly, I don't quite get that practice, but body parts of saints were a big deal in the day. I've seen a saint's finger and arm, I think. Honestly, can't quite remember what I saw, but it was parts of her in different places. It didn't do anything for me, but it teached her own, I guess. Anyways, the other city refused for a time to provide these items in the belief that it was helping to protect them. Though Messina was eventually successful in getting some of the relics and they were able to spread some holy water around the city, the plague didn't really seem to care. The other city, where the relics originally were, also became infected. To this day, nobody knows how many died on the island of Sicily, though according to one record, the dead seemed to outnumber the living, as human remains could be found everywhere. The rest of Italy fared as well as Sicily did. For those that have never read anything about Italian history, here's a brief introduction. The united country known as Italy only came into existence during the 1800s. Before that, it was a series of little kingdoms or territories ruled by a single family or republic. For example, Venice was a republic and ruled by a council for over 1,000 years. Milan was ruled by the Sforzas, and Florence by the Medicis. Rome, of course, was ruled mostly by the Vatican, and they all pretty much hated each other and were in constant battles for control over various territories. Seriously, take some time and read about the history of Italy in the Middle Ages. It's fascinating. Anyway, the plague eventually arrived in Genoa in December. It's estimated that a third of the city died, between 80 and 90,000. It was the Genoas that brought the plague to Venice, their most bitter enemy, due to their fighting over trade routes. Just a bit of geography, whereas Venice is on the northeastern side of the country, Genoa is catty-corner on the northwestern part of the country. Known often as the city on water, Venice carried on fairly well, despite losing roughly 60% or so of its population, or about 72,000 people. Florence had one of the plague's most prominent chroniclers, Giovanni Boccaccio, who we heard from in the introduction. He wrote, quote, "Such was the multitude of corpses that huge trenches were excavated in churchyards, into which new arrivals were placed in their hundreds, stored tier upon tier, like ship's cargo, each layer of corpses being covered with a thin layer of soil till the trench was filled to the top. The plague claimed roughly 50,000 lives, or half the city. Italy, most historians agree, was hardest hit by the Black Death. The first city in France to experience the joys of the plague was Marseille, a coastal city in the south of France. Again, the Genoas were the instigators. The word was reaching various ports about the pestilence that the Genoan fleets brought. They would do their best to try to break through whatever screening process was set up in order to hawk their wares. It arrived in the port on November 1st, All Saints' Day. It didn't take long for the disease to jump ship from its dying men to the healthy people of Marseille. It wasn't the first time the plague had been to the city either. It was there in 543 during the reign of Justinian, and it took a devastating toll on the city. Marseille lost between 20 and 25,000 of its residents, or again, half the population. The city was interesting because it also was like Venice and able to maintain a bit of calm and order among the chaos of half the city disappearing. It also didn't attack its Jewish neighbors, as other cities did during the outbreak. The growth of anti-Semitism in Europe during the Middle Ages before the plague is a story for another time, but it did grow in intensity and often violence during the plague. The most frequent charge was that the Jewish population, planted there by the Romans after the diaspora in the first century, were poisoning wells and spreading the pestilence across the continent. The narrative fit well and gave the Europeans an unjustified group to blame. It was an unfortunate combination of prejudice, ignorance, and fear. In many cities, like Geneva and Avignon, Jews were killed outright for something they had absolutely no part in and no control of. It didn't help that many Jews at this time were moneylenders, an occupation that they could only have since they were shut out of many other aspects of society. So if you can't pay your loan back, there was an extra incentive for various cities and towns to blame and kill their moneylenders. Boom. No more debt. And in the chaos of the plague, that probably in the chaos after the plague, I'm sure many people were supportive of that. But it was not the case in Marseille. Avignon, a southern interior French city, played host for many years to the Catholic papacy during this time. It was there where the popes were able to both relax and avoid some of the more moral restrictions of Rome. Starting with Clement V, most of the ruling members of the Vatican lived and worked in the papal palace built in the city, which is a great example of Gothic architecture and appears, at least from and pictures, definitely worth a visit. Several popes were also elected in Avignon during this time. It was there where Clement VI resided and eventually fled during the Black Death. The city's death toll was probably about 56,000, or about 50%. In Paris, about 50,000 or so died, which is about a third of the city at that time. The plague also struck in Normandy and Rouen, famously home of Joan of Arc. The plague then moved on to England, which had been hearing rumors and stories about the plague for at least a year by this point. Even the teenage daughter of Edward III, Princess Joan, died in Bordeaux, France, on her way to see her future husband in Spain. The town of Melcombe was likely the first town where the pestilence landed. It's another seaside town on the southern coast of Britain, but instead of coming from the Genoa ships, this time the plague came via the booty taken from the sacking of Calicis, a French city which was plague-riddled. The information we have about the toll that the plague told in Melcombe is entirely anecdotal. In the 1350s, Edward III declared that the area was so depopulated because of the pestilence that the town would be incorporated into Weymouth. This happened all over England, which in a way differentiated itself from the rest of Europe. Even centuries later, entire towns, especially coastal towns, remained deserted to the point where King Henry VIII ordered their repair. Though England was a chronicler of the legal aspects of death on such a mass scale, the chroniclers, as we've seen in other countries, were more unusual. It was also interesting that the loss of priests in the plague was especially well documented. For example, in Dorset, there were 32 clerical vacancies within about 2 months. In Sedisbury, 3 priests appointed to the town died within a month. There were also massive losses among animals, likely the combination of a specific disease spreading at the time due to the rain and the plague as well. It's estimated that about 20% of the aristocracy died, 42 to 45% of the country's priests died, and between 40 and 70% of the peasantry. The country's biggest city, London, likely lost about 50% of its population. The plague went as far west as Portugal and Spain, where it claimed the life of Alfonso, King of Castile. It also got as far east as Poland and north into Sweden and Norway, before finally making a full circle back into the Balkans area. It was a time of chaos in some areas and numb resignation in others. But once the great mortality passed, things quickly changed. Part 4. Post-Black Death Europe. The time after the plague was marked by explosive growth, innovation, and a certain amount of debauchery in Europe. It seemed like after being so closed off for so long, most people were finally ready to cut loose. The birth rates went up, but towns and cities still struggled to reclaim the same population. Some wouldn't achieve it until centuries later, in the 1800s. There was also a certain decline in infrastructure, but also a rise in the need for labor. Peasants were actually able, in many cases, to pull themselves out of poverty and achieve stability that some never had. The serf system basically died out as people were able to get wages for their labor, and fathers were even able to leave farms and properties to their children, even daughters. Women were also able to more fully enter the workforce after the plague, due to the need for skilled labor. This time also led to a greater interest in books and reading, eventually leading to the development of Gutenberg's printing press. There was a growth in medical research and medical training as the restrictions on autopsies lessened. Hospitals became a greater fixture in society, and special wards were created to house people with similar ailments. The institution that was perhaps hardest hit by the plague was the church. Due to the perception of unanswered prayers and many priests deserting their parishioners as they tried to escape the plague, people instead wanted a more personal relationship with God. So while the plague did not directly result in the Reformation, it definitely laid the groundwork. The plague would resurface every now and again, but never in the same ferocity as it did before. Overall, the plague both greatly weakened Europe and destroyed cities and towns, but it also awoke a certain amount of innovation. The labor shortage meant that new technology was developed in order to offset the lack of workers. Eventually, Europe embraced the Renaissance period and the Reformation, two pivotal events. Part 5. What we can learn. As I was developing this podcast idea, one of the things that I was really interested in exploring is how a historical event impacts us today. Here are some ways that this ancient pestilence has shaped our world. For those of European and also Asian descent, it means that many of us have a bit of immunity to the Black Death. Now, I don't want to overstate this. If you had the plague, please seek medical attention immediately. But some of us are here today simply because our family survived. It's really crazy when you think about it. We have hospital and quarantine measures in part because of the Black Death. As discussed earlier, after the plague, hospitals and their purpose, which were originally more like prisons than actual health centers, began to actually practice some medicine and create wards to actually administer healthcare to patients. Doctors were also given more training and wanted more training in understanding how diseases spread. Some cities also tried to do some self-quarantining. It didn't always work, but they understood that to a certain extent, limiting the spread of the disease by avoiding exposure was the smart course of action. We've, of course, expanded our understanding in medicine a great deal since that time. Finally, we also have some hope for the future. While a pandemic like COVID-19 is terrifying, life will, at some point, get back to normal. That should be an encouragement to us all. And that is history. Thank you so much for listening to History with Brittany. You can find me online at www.historywithbrittany.com, on Facebook at History with Brittany, Twitter with the handle at History with W Britt, and Instagram at History with Brittany. Drop me a line and let me know what topics you would like to learn more about. Thank you so much for listening.